Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show. It is October 15th, 2011, and I have on the line my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay. I hope you don't hear too many sounds of chainsawing going on in the background, but here, there are people out chainsawing, but it seems to have stopped at the moment. We got fall coming on. I thought I'm going to just give a very brief summary of some of the main areas and discussions we have on the Zero Point Show. And then I thought today we were going to discuss Beelzebub's tales and some of Gurdjieff's views on the causes of war and such. So sounds good. Okay, Jim?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I think the most important concept or area of study that we explore is the psychology of consciousness. And and I'll speak for Jim and I because I think we share this perspective. We would differentiate consciousness from various psychological functions, such as thinking, feeling, perceiving, acting, sensation, and the like. So consciousness is something else. It's not thinking, it's not feeling, it's not action, it's not sensation, even though there can be consciousness of thought, consciousness of emotions, consciousness of feelings or impulses, consciousness of perceptions, and so on. But the consciousness itself is somehow something separate from the psychological functions. And this was an idea that Jim and I were exposed to early in our studies of the fourth way teaching of Gurdjieff. And it's an idea that is profoundly important because in psychology at that time and even today, they mainly followed the juncture of William James, an early kind of philosopher and psychologist, who said, by states of consciousness are meant such things as thoughts, reasonings, volitions, perceptions, and the like. So William James tended to equate consciousness itself with the thought, the sum of the thinking, the emotions, the perceptions, and so on. All of those together gave you the consciousness. But he didn't think that consciousness was anything over and above those psychological processes. So this is a very important concept, and it distinguishes an esoteric view of consciousness from the predominant Western psychological and scientific view. So, and it suggests that the consciousness is something separate simply from the activities of the mind and the mental activities or cognitive activities. That is something else. And also, you can be conscious of your thoughts in your head, but you can also kind of be conscious in your feet, or you could be conscious in your stomach, or you can be conscious in different ways throughout your body. So consciousness seems a more pervasive thing, or possibly pervasive, whereas the things you're conscious of are more localized. Like you can be conscious of thoughts in your head, or you can be conscious of sensations in different parts of your body. So the consciousness somehow is different from the psychological functions. Next important idea in trying to understand consciousness, and by consciousness, in a way, what I'm referring to is our inner awareness of being. That's how I like to define it in a simple way. Like each of us has a kind of inner awareness proceeding at any moment in time. I know I do as I am sit here and am speaking. We all have that inner awareness of being proceeding within us. And that, in a general way, is what I mean by consciousness. Okay, and then we can be conscious of all these different things. thoughts and feelings and sensations and so on. So then the next really important idea is to consider consciousness as light. And in a way, this is analogous to what we have in the world around us. Like if I have a light source, a lamp here in my room, and it illuminates the carpet and the walls and a mirror and the telephone and so on. So you have a source of light, and that light can illuminate all these different things. But you wouldn't say that the mirror and the carpet and the cup and the telephone constitute light. No, it's that the light illuminates those different objects. So there's kind of the light side and the material side. In Vedic teachings, it's called Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is like consciousness and spirit, and it illuminates Prakriti, which is material nature. And in the Vedas, there are said to be 7 levels of Prakriti, and then an 8th level, which is called the fundamental Prakriti. So it kind of follows what we discuss, the law of 7, the sevenfoldness of Prakriti, or material nature. So consciousness can illuminate different objects and of different subtleties of material nature. So the idea of consciousness as light is very important. And throughout the mystical tradition, the main view is that humankind is asleep. That the masses of humankind are in essentially a sleepwalking state. And they're conditioned and controlled by their upbringing and their educational and socialization influences. But they're asleep to their essential nature. Gurdjieff describes describes people as machines, or we might imagine as robots. And the idea is that human beings live in darkness. Okay, and in the Bible, it's like humankind live in darkness, and we have to gain the light which is within ourselves. Okay, so that the idea there is that there's a light within ourselves. So just as we can have light in the outer world that illuminates things, so we might have an inherent light source within ourselves. And the mystics associate this inherent light source with the human heart. In the Vedas, it's called the Jiva Atma, and it's described as like a point. There are different descriptions. It's described as an infinitesimally small point. I think they say 1/10,000th of a horse's hair, but it could be infinitely small. And then that is said to be embodied in what is called the bliss sheath in the heart, which is the size of a small grape. So the idea is that Jiva Atma is a point source, but then it has its abode in the body, in the bliss sheath associated with the heart. And that is described also as your causal body. And this bliss sheath is described as a, quote, mass of unemergent light. So if you could think of light as contained in the volume of space instead of light just radiating away. In fiber optics, I think they're learning how to do this, contain light within space. So this, in the mystical teachings, this Jiva Atma is inherently self-illuminating like the sun. Okay, so in the outer world, the sun illuminates things on Earth, and it also warms them and gives them life in a way. So similarly, the Jiva Atma within the heart is said to, its light is that of consciousness. And this light, and it's also the Jiva Atma is described as the vital element within the human being. Because of the Jiva Atma, it helps to generate the heartbeat in the SA node, and which spreads in 3 phases through the heart, the generation of the heartbeat. okay, which is a phenomenon unexplained within modern science in the material perspective. So the mystical view suggests that there's this little light entity associated with the heart that brings consciousness and vitality into a human being. And the consciousness in the human being from conception, as the infant grows, the heart area grows first, and then it's from the heart that the consciousness spreads then out all through the body. And it's connected to the blood and the oxygenation of the blood, because man is said to be ensouled through the breath. So the spirit connects to the body, it's this consciousness connects to the body through the breath and the oxygenation of the blood. And you have the circulation of vitality all through a person through the blood. So this is a mystical conception of human consciousness, that we have some mysterious kind of element connected to the heart. And when mystics say, know thyself, in a way there are different levels to that. In a way, we begin with trying to know ourselves in a practical way, like to know ourselves as we are now. And we try to study ourselves and learn to understand our egoism or false personality is what Gurdjieff labels it. We try to understand false personality within ourselves and to struggle with it in different ways. For Gurdjieff, an individual to attain real I, they have to grow in their essence. Your essence is what you are in your being. But as you grow up, you're conditioned and influenced by everything about you and your experiences, so you form a secondary self, an outer personality. And that can form into patterns of what Gurdjieff calls false personality. Gurdjieff suggests then that our essential consciousness passes into the subconsciousness. And instead, we form a dual consciousness system, and he says in human beings this is crystallized around their own egoism. So what we explore through this series then is trying to understand consciousness. Consciousness as light. Consciousness connected to the heart and the blood in the body. Trying to understand consciousness as something separate from the other psychological functions. And then we also try to understand consciousness, as Gurdjieff says, in order to understand consciousness, you have to acquire it. Like, if we're just very unconscious, we can't understand what consciousness is. So what consciousness is in oneself, like how much of it you have and of what form it is, can vary. So we have to try to begin to study this phenomena of consciousness within ourselves, trying to understand it. And when we begin, we realize how much we do things automatically and unconsciously, and how we've been conditioned in all different ways. And we study elements of our false personality. We try to become aware of these things. And we strive to attain to knowledge of the self, which in the Judaism is described as under our noses all the time, referring to the heart. Okay, so there are said within the mystical spiritual traditions that there are mysteries to the human heart. And I explained the heart isn't simply a physical thing, but there's a psychical heart, a spiritual level to the heart, and a divine element, ultimately. So the idea is that there's a whole higher dimensional science to the human heart. And such an idea is suggested to us by the writings and poetry of a wide range of mystical teachers and religious figures from different traditions. So we explore the heart doctrine, and we also explore the idea of a human being as having a zero-point center. And that's difficult to explain what I mean by that. is, or what is meant by that, and it has different meanings. But the idea is that we have a first point within ourselves, and in a way, that first point is our I. Okay, that, like, people wonder, does a human being have a self, or does he have an I? And the scientists and psychologists and philosophers, no one thinks a human being has a singular I. Okay, instead, the current tendency is to think that our essential self is wrapped up in our DNA. But if you look at, like, strands of DNA, you know, there's no singular I within all these strands of DNA, because that's just saying that there is no individual I. All there is are these little particles. But mystical teachings suggest there is some kind of individual I, some kind of quanta element, an I element. And it's described, Blavatsky describes it as a monad. So it's like a point source of light and life. It's like a living entity in a person is said to be the monadic essence. Okay, even though it's not exactly in the person, because in a way it exists in higher dimensional space, and the body in a way forms surrounding our central point. So I argue this very unusual idea that a human being has a singular I connected to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. And this concept is very profound. I can't swear that I know absolutely that this is the truth, but it is a way of trying to understand yourself and the world and mystical and spiritual teachings and science, that in a way all makes sense and helps bring other areas of knowledge and teaching together. So we explore these teachings of the heart doctrine, I call it, and the zero-point hypothesis, the hypothesis that human beings have such a singular eye and life center within them. And then we also explore other things. Hi, Jim. Any comments, Jim?
Oh, yeah, sorry, but I don't know if you heard the cat.
Oh, yeah, was that a cat? I heard a bit of rustle or something at some point.
Sorry, he was demanding to be let in, and then he was demanding to be let out. I just go back to something very basic that you said at the beginning, which it was very good, by the way, is it's this idea. I remember reading in Uspensky articulating the fourth way, and at the beginning trying to understand that. Like, it's interesting, we are both psychology graduate students, how little attention is paid to the nature of the I experience, but also just to what is consciousness, which is essentially the most basic question, psychological question, and yet we were both graduate students in psychology, and you can get a PhD in psychology and never have one thought about what the nature of human consciousness is. It's just, it's a question that is been pushed out of psychology for many years and had only begun to reemerge in the mid-70s when we were in graduate school. But I think when I reading Uspensky, it really struck me was when he insisted that consciousness must be understood as something which is different from the psychological functions. And I think that's the most essential basic mistake that is made in the assumptive framework of modern science and psychology about consciousness is that in trying to explain how consciousness emerges from the brain, consciousness is typically associated with the psychological functions. But when you have this different perspective that, no, it's not the psychological functions, it's something separate, and when you have the idea that it can be likened to light, and that that comparison, explanation that consciousness is light can be understood on so many different levels. That's one of the most intriguing things about it, is that it's a psychological, metaphorical description, but it's also meant to be true in a sense, literally, as electromagnetic light, but also as a different quality of light, a higher dimensional supernal light, and it can be understood in a variety of ways. But even in as a metaphor, that consciousness is something that illuminates things. So we can be more or less consciousness with more or less light in our lives, and we can be more or less aware of everything in our psychological functioning. It depends on how much light we can throw on it. So just as you said, you have the objects in the room, and if the room is almost completely darkened, your perception and your understanding and your apprehension of those objects is going to be very fuzzy, it's going to be very dim. But if you have more light, then you have a more coherent understanding of what the nature of those objects is. Your perception will be sharpened as to what they are. And that, on a most basic level, combined with the idea that you can study consciousness within yourself, which is really the most essential aspect of esotericism's approach to the study of consciousness, is that you can study this within yourself. You begin to realize that your state of consciousness is continually changing, and it is, for the most part, contrary to popular belief and to our conventional assumptions about it scientifically, we operate in a very low level of consciousness, as you say, almost like robots or automatons, very mechanically. But, and this is the big but, because in a sense that's what behaviorism in psychology is asserting, is that we function quite mechanically. But the difference between the esoteric approach and that of modern psychology is to say that consciousness is variable, so that you, through effort, can become more conscious and can throw more light on things. And in doing so, it changes the whole quality of your experience of yourself and of everything in your psychological functioning. And a lot of psychological functions that operate very mechanically and very automatically can be changed just by the observation and by the awareness of yourself, i.e. by becoming more conscious of yourself. You can actually change some of those functions simply by becoming more aware of them. So what you realize is that consciousness is much more dynamic and is not at all it's much more dynamic than is supposed by modern psychologists and scientists, but also this idea that it's not your psychological functions. And I think this is like the most critical distinction. And combined with the methodology of self-study, or rather more appropriately, systematic self-study, changes the whole nature of approaching and studying consciousness. It puts it on an entirely different level and leads to an entirely different set of data in terms of trying to understand the nature of conscious experience. And again, as you said before, one of the things that over time which emerges is that the nature of the I experience is so much more complicated and so much more profound than anybody in Western science or psychology recognizes. And again, you know, whether or not this is correct, at the very least, this is a most incredibly useful heuristic for studying yourself and studying consciousness, because it really makes clear the nature of the assumptive framework with which people in Western science and psychology and philosophy, for the most part, have studied consciousness for the last several hundred years. And it really brings into question whether or not this framework the Western framework is entirely wrong. I would say that it is, based on my own experience, your experience, what we're trying to articulate here. But, you know,
when it comes to the issue of consciousness, I think we'd both agree how much Western psychology and science has advanced in understanding all different kind of cognitive and mental processes and perceptual processes, all that go on in the mind.
Yeah, neurological processes in the brain, but that...
Yeah,
you know,
they assume that's the consciousness, though, and they don't... And I think they never take the perspective on consciousness that we have to study it within ourselves. That's what was so distinctive about Gurdjieff's teaching when I encountered it 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And then it became, like, in a way, it was so much fun trying to study consciousness in yourself. Like, it made life, in a way, an adventure because you'd be trying to remember yourself. So you'd be going out somewhere and you'd set the intention to try to remember yourself, and you'd maintain that awareness for a little while, and then the next thing you know, it's a half hour later and you forgot yourself again, and then you try to remember yourself again, and you try to have moments of that being more self-aware and present at different times through your day. And you could just see how most of the time you were kind of completely absorbed in what you were doing, but you weren't self-aware at the same time as you're doing what you're doing. And this is partly what Gurdjieff, he's saying most people attain only the state of relative consciousness, or he calls it waking sleep. But they don't attain to the state of what he calls self-consciousness. Okay. But unfortunately, people think they already have self-consciousness. But for Gurdjieff, really what they have is this kind of egoic-centered consciousness. So they don't have true self-consciousness. And this is something we have to attain. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't just happen. That's what Gurdjieff says. The evolution of a human being up through the types is the evolution of consciousness. And the consciousness cannot evolve unconsciously. And it's the evolution of man involves the development of will in the human being so that you attain true will. But Gurdjieff says, this can't happen. See, it can't just happen and you attain true will. You have to strive for it, in a sense. And the third thing he says, we have a multiplicity of eyes. And he quotes the Bible of all the... Man's name is Legion.
Yeah,
man's name is Legion. That you're always saying I all the time. Everybody thinks you know your I. You know, I am hungry. You know, I am tired. I am happy. I'm sad. I'm pissed off. I'm worried. I'm fearful. I to everything. So man's name is Legion. We say I to everything, but we don't know pure I or I in a purer state. As kind of behind, as the observer and as a source of awareness behind all of these things. But we can cultivate that. And doing it made life an adventure, has made life an adventure. And at all different times, you become aware of certain things you become aware of and consciousness almost dissolves them. And you cannot do or say what you were about to do or say. You learn to detach and not identify with certain states and negative emotions and worries and things along that line. And you learn to detach from those and separate from them. It's said in the work sometimes that man is first one, and that's when you just act it out. And then you are two. And when you're two, that means that you kind of divide the observer from it. Gurdjieff sometimes even talks about our functioning as it. So there's the I and the it. And you create that separation. And then the ultimate aim is to become one again. But by then, you need to be established in your essence. So Gurdjieff says that a human being has to attain his true I. And that's a concept throughout the mystical literature. And I think a common theme to Gurdjieff and to the mystical tradition generally, Jim, is that they have a concept of how a human being can strive for their own self-perfection in terms of being. And that's the kind of basis for different meditative and different disciplines in different spiritual traditions, that they have a concept of striving towards one's own self-perfection in some way. And I don't think we see that at all in Western psychology, because everything is only on one level.
Yeah, precisely, and everything in Western psychology involves, even in therapy and in terms of personality development, it's really changed. But whereas in the mystical and esoteric tradition, they talk about transformation, as you say, it's that within all of the mystical and esoteric teachings, that the idea is that somehow in our normal waking state, we are not what we can become and what we can realize as our true essence, which is somehow forgotten. I mean, in Plato, he talks about truth is no forgetting, and he says that we're sewn into the instrument of time and we forget ourselves. And I think that metaphorically describes most of the mystical and esoteric tradition's position too, is that we become identified with the egoic processes and with our physical selves and become, in Gurdjieff's terms, identified with our personalities and our false personalities, everything we acquire through our contact with life and through our education and socialization and upbringing. But
it's also, just to interrupt, sorry, but
yeah,
it was reminding me of the myth of the loss of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see that, like, that's Plato's higher noetic realm,
yeah,
or ideal realm, and then we're sewn into the instrument of time, so Adam and Eve are kind of expelled from the garden,
yeah.
And then the idea is to kind of return to Eden. How do we kind of reascend or...
But all of these myths speak of transformation, and the idea is that it's not just a change, it's something fundamentally so different that it exists on an entirely different level of being and consciousness.
It's like a quantum leap.
Yeah, there
instead
again.
Instead of being on a continuum.
Yeah, there again, we don't have that idea in modern psychology and science. Essentially, consciousness is just seen, there's really only two states that are recognized within modern science and psychology. Either you're awake or you're asleep, and then within the waking state, you can be very dimly conscious, like almost asleep, and then you can be sort of more alert. I think you quote that Scientific American article where the guy essentially says that's the continuum of consciousness. But within the mystical and esoteric tradition, there are all these higher levels of consciousness and being, which, as you say, are quantumly disconnected from they involve a quantum development that they're on an entirely different level. And again and again and again, we see reference to this in the mystical and esoteric tradition, is that these higher states exist, and that to really truly realize ourselves and to be who we really are, we have to awaken from the slumber, this waking sleep, or this lower state of waking consciousness, and develop our true I rather than being identified with the false I of our egoic processes, and overcome our current state, our waking state, and realize who we really are. And this exists in different levels too. So in a way, when we want to know ourselves, it's like you say, at the beginning we have to try to be observant and to start to try to understand how we are not what we think we are and how we are really are asleep. And then gradually knowing yourself takes on a very different meaning. You start to realize, well, to know yourself also means to sort of somehow awaken or make contact with something that's more essential. And when you're studying yourself at the beginning, you have glimpses of this or flashes of it, and you start to realize that you get a taste. It's very difficult to describe, but you do get a taste that there is something more subtle, more real, more essential within yourself that if you could really wake up, you would have a more coherent and full experience of this, and a more continuous experience of this, and that's what the goal is. And in a way, it's an awful thing to begin at the beginning to see how asleep you are, but at the same time, the motivation to continue as you realize is like, well, if I really could awaken to some extent, my life, the quality of my life would change so dramatically and would be so much better, and I would be more the master of myself and more, I'd possess more the capacities that we assign to ourselves already, that we attribute to ourselves in our normal waking state, which is that we have will and that we're unified conscious beings. But the self-study really reveals that that's not the case, that most of our waking experience consists of very automatic and mechanical reactions to internal and external stimuli, and that we don't really have a coherent, I, other than in the sense that we identify who we are with our continuous physical existence. But the real I element is not there, is not unified, is not coherent, but we somehow gain a suspicion that if we were different, we could realize that.
And it's funny all the while, because in a way, people are quite correct, because in a way, people feel that it is always there, and in a way, even Gurdjieff says it is always there.
Yeah, it's just in the... It's very,
yeah, it's us making connection with it more.
Yeah, exactly. No connection. And that's...
Yeah. And also he emphasizes, like, to make connection with real I, we have to refine the energies for our subtle bodies. Because the real I has three bodies, in a sense, a mental or spiritual body, an emotional or astral body, and a material body. So there's really three bodies. And Gurdjieff sees the astral body and what he calls the Kesjan body, the mental spiritual body. He calls it the Kesjan body. He describes how we have to refine the elements for the astral and mental bodies. And he criticizes theosophy because it kind of leads to the belief that everybody's got an astral and mental body. But Gurdjieff's view is, although everybody has astral matters within their constitution, that they can't function independently in their astral or mental bodies, that we have to develop the faculties of these higher being bodies, and that these then provide the vehicle for the life of the soul. So for Gurdjieff, in a way, he talks about attaining your soul, and that, he emphasizes, developing these higher being bodies, particularly the mental body.
Yeah, and in
and
his
attaining
term,
I is the fourth room he describes. Sorry, Jim?
No, I was just going to say, in his terminology, the Kesjan, the translation of Kesjan is, it's the vessel of the soul. And as you say, he differs from some other spiritual traditions and mystical perspectives, and saying that he says that we have these bodies, but he said you can live a normal existence without really having any significant effect on you, that you don't have a permanent soul. Like, we have a soul element within ourselves, but it, through our actions and our development of our consciousness within our existence, that we can attain the soul. So it's not something that's simply just given to us. And it's very complex, kind of what he's saying about,
yeah.
I think, the survival of an element past the death of the physical body. I think he's saying that to really realize the soul is an achievement. It's something that we have to work through in our life experience to in his terms, crystallize these higher being bodies within ourselves at these higher levels, like at the astral and mental levels. And that is, in a sense, gives us a certain degree of immortality. But even that, he says, is sort of limited within the position of humankind in the cosmological scheme. It's a very sophisticated and very different kind of scheme, and in that sense, I think Gurdjieff's very different from other mystical and esoteric perspectives. I think he's saying something, at least as I understand it, I think he's saying something quite different. He's a very different emphasis, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it ties in also to his ray of creation, because
yeah.
he sees man as a microcosm of the macrocosm. So we have these different levels within ourselves. Like, on one level, we're on Earth, but then there's one aspect of ourself connected to the moon. And Gurdjieff says that when anything dies, its soul passes to the moon, or some of its soul energies passes to the moon. And he describes the moon as a great electromagnetic element that draws and lives off the souls of the death of organic beings on the earth. And that's why, as we'll see in his tales when we come to it, it's like wars. When there's wars and bloodshed on earth, then it kind of feeds the moon. Okay, so Gurdjieff would talk in that way, and let's see, he describes in his tales at some point there's so many loss of souls that it kind of creates this imbalance, cosmic imbalance, because of the overabundance of these soul energies feeding the moon. At points, he even describes the hell world, one hell world, as on the dark side of the moon, and it's like a person there is most removed from the light. Every level in the ray of creation, you're further removed from the light. So the lower worlds can be into the, a soul might pass into the moon and live there in kind of servitude under 96 laws, Gurdjieff says. Whereas on the earth, he says there are 48 laws. And related to the planets, he says there are different numbers of laws at different levels of this cosmic organization. And the more laws there are, the more restricted and bound that consciousness. So in the Gurdjieff work, our aim is, he says the aim is to attain to the fourth room. So that's beginning from the bottom, the physical, the astral, the mental, and then the fourth is seen as, it's related in his cosmic octave to the world of all stars, like to the level of the galaxy. And below that is the level of the sun, which is connected to the mental body. And below that is the astral body, and it's connected to the planet. So he relates different of our being bodies to different levels of the cosmic organization. And in a way, you see, we live in all worlds at one time. We're influenced by the moon and the earth and the planets and the sun and our position in the galaxy and then our position in all worlds. There's a sense that we live in all of these worlds simultaneously. So our afterlife fate, we can be eaten by the moon or we can attain to the sun. And that's the aim, I guess, in spiritual, that in like Tibetan Buddhism, when a person dies, they read the Tibetan Buddhist Book of the Dead to them, or they may, and the first aim is for the yogi to attain to the greater body of radiance upon their death, to pass into and attain the greater body of radiance. And then if he can't attain that, he wants to attain to the lesser body of radiance. I would say the greater body of radiance is the galaxy or that level, and the lesser body of radiance, I would say, is the sun. And then if the person doesn't attain to those levels, then there are different bardos or planes that the soul can pass into. So for Gurdjieff, it's similar to theosophy and Buddhism and other teachings. There's different afterlife dimensions that people can pass into upon death. They can haunt the earth as ghosts, and they can pass into lower hell-like conditions. They can attain to the sun and a level of spiritual existence. So in a way, it's as a person has sown, so shall they reap. In Gurdjieff's view, that's why we have to kind of struggle to strive for towards our own self-perfection, so that we can attain to higher conditions of afterlife existence and further our own evolution. At one point, Gurdjieff says, it's like everybody has a divine spark within them, so ultimately everybody will evolve through all the stages. But Gurdjieff says, but that is on such unbelievable time periods that it's not meaningful to an individual in your life to think that in billions and trillions and quadrillions of years, you know, I'll evolve and attain realization. So he says we can't be concerned with that time scale. So what we have to do is strive for our own evolution within our own life, and to understand what that means, what evolution is in the Gurdjieff sense. See, Gurdjieff says that there are seven levels of human beings, and that each of these levels is a quantum jump from a level below, and it's distinctively different with different properties and such. He says most people are on level 1, 2, and 3, a physically centered man, an emotionally centered man, or a intellectual, mentally centered individual. And so people mainly are on man number 1, 2, and 3s in different kind of combinations of their functions. He says the first level of awakening, and he compares it to a musical scale also, where you begin from a bottom, do, re, mi. And then as in the musical octave, he says there's a missing semitone. So the music doesn't progress evenly too far. It tends to go do, re, mi, and not get to fa in people, because Gurdjieff says there's a missing semitone. And he says for a person to get to the fourth level, there has to be a shock of some kind, something that in a way breaks up or breaks down the existing organization, or something that brings about transformation in the person to attain to this next level, man number 4. He describes a man number 4 has attained a certain balanced development mentally, emotionally, and physically, and they've attained to this state of self-consciousness, experiencing I within their essence, which I is like the core of your essence. But a man number 4 isn't constant in that awareness. He can attain it at points, but it's not stable in them, which is what is the condition of a man number 5. So Gurdjieff describes men number 4 and 5 also as experiencing different types of higher emotions or sacred being impulses. And then a man number 6 or 7 is someone who's attained his eyes, but his true eye, and then experiences different levels of objective consciousness, which is knowledge and understanding of the universe and the nature of being and such. So, and Gurdjieff says it's impossible for us to kind of understand what it might be to be of a higher type, because it's like a blind person talking of color, because in a way one has to work on oneself to kind of understand what these subtle differences might mean. But certainly, AJM, it was like Gurdjieff's whole concept of... I don't think I ever read of anyone in the mainstream of psychology ever discuss even the concept of the idea of there being an individual I within the human being. I've never even heard anyone philosophize about it. I guess, even to deny it. Like no one even had the concept deny it or something.
Yeah, it's funny because I was trying to think of the same thing. I was trying to think in psychology, like self theories. You know, I remember taking a whole course with Roger Wells on self theories, and people discuss the self especially in the earlier days in psychology, and then it sort of, with a rise of behaviorism, it sort of was pushed to the side, and then you have certain people in personality theory and psychology who talk about the self, but nobody, not the way we're talking about the I, but it's peculiar because in a way, I mean, then you have like in psychoanalysis, you have ego theories, but nobody really talks about the I experience as to what it is. It's kind of, it's beyond the realm of discussion in a sense. It's very peculiar. It wasn't until like a few years ago that it really sort of struck me. It's like, it's really weird, you know, when you think about it. It's like the most basic thing. Well, it's just as weird as the idea that psychologists tried to study psychology without studying consciousness. I mean, it sort of goes in hand, but it also...
Or without studying themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It, you know, I mean, historically, I guess it goes back to the introspectionists who, that's why I made the distinction earlier when I said that, you know, it's a systematic study of yourself, because the problem with introspectionism as a school of thought and psychology is that there was nothing systemic about it, is that they sort of just did it willy-nilly and didn't really come up with a whole lot of insight, whereas, ironically, the whole tradition in Eastern psychology has been to study yourself and through meditation and through various practices such as self-remembering, which is a form of sort of waking, moving meditation. But it's so peculiar. It's a very complex thing, but in a way it's just downright strange how this has eluded Western psychologists and nobody really talks about it. And I think it's, again, like with consciousness, there's a certain school of thought within the materialist perspective is that, well, really, consciousness is nothing really other than a name for what the brain does, for the psychological functions which are produced by the brain. So there's this sort of reductionist perspective and approach to things. And the I experience is really nothing more than the sort of an epiphenomenon. It's associated with the continuous existence of the physical body, but there's no real I.
So it's just sort of
discarded as a non-issue, and I think that really accounts in large part for why people haven't delved into it. And yet, from the mystical and esoteric perspective, when you begin to study yourself systematically, what you come to eventually is this question. It's like, well, what is the nature of the I experience? It's certainly much more complicated and complex than people acknowledge. As you said, like the one of the real revelations, I think, for both of us, and really convinced me in large part about the substance of the fourth way teaching, was this idea that we have many different eyes in ourselves and no consistent eye, and that one moment we're one person and another moment we're another person, and often we have very conflicting eyes within us with completely different goals. It's like the old joke about, you know, the eye that goes to bed at night vowing to get up early in the morning and to begin a rigorous exercise program is nowhere to be found when the alarm clock goes off. But I mean, it's like that throughout. That's what self-study.
Yeah, from one moment to the next.
Yeah. It's like, my favorite example of this was on The Simpsons one time and this applies to you moments of relative awakening when you're studying yourself, is you suddenly have a moment when you really do feel more awake, and then 45 minutes later you realize that you slipped back into unconsciousness and you've been basically on automatic pilot for the last 45 minutes since your moment of relatively awakened consciousness. It disappears. And I remember on The Simpsons one time, and there's a moment when Homer comes out of Moe's bar, and he runs into his exact double, and there's a crowd of people around, and then there's this big, big moment. He goes, and everybody sort of gasps, and there's this moment of like, wow, this is amazing. And then a dog runs by, and Homer says, "Look, everybody, a dog with a fluffy tail," and they all chase after the dog with a fluffy tail. That's kind of like us from moment to moment. Eh? It's like, yes, the dog with a fluffy tail runs by, everybody's distracted and forgets this great moment of awakening. And that's even for people who are trying to awaken or are trying to develop consciousness. Mm-hmm. In some sense, it's immensely frustrating and humbling, but that's the reality, is that we slip back into the deep lake. We slip back into the waking sleep and forget ourselves again. But that's one aspect of the I experience. And then it's this whole other thing, as you said before, like as you go deeper, you begin to realize, well, but that doesn't mean that's the I experience in the normal waking state of consciousness. But then there's the depiction of the I experience, which is related to the dynamics of the heart and the higher dimensions of the heart, which is something completely different. It's this idea of the God spark which is repeated within several mystical and esoteric traditions and spiritual teachings. This idea of a God spark or some sort of higher dimensional light source, which is infinitesimally small and which is effectively a zero point because it passes from one dimension into another, existing within our hearts, and that we have it within our hearts. We have our physical heart, but then we have our higher dimensional heart spaces, which are related to these higher dimensions, cosmological dimensions, and this throws the whole question of the eye experience into something quite different. And then from that perspective, we have a way of understanding all sorts of anomalous phenomena when people have higher dimensional experiences of the eye and unity of themselves with the universe, or experiences of eye in higher dimensions, such as in the near-death experience. So it provides a framework for understanding this, and really quite profoundly providing this perspective where, okay, what happens if the physical body stops functioning? According to the materialist position, we should have no eye experience. It should be coterminous with the death of the physical body. And yet the near-death literature shows over and over again that just doesn't happen, and that somehow there is some higher dimensional element in which people retain not only their sense of self and their identity, but to a certain extent their perceptive faculties are not only intact but are increased and possess certain capacities that we don't possess in our normal waking state. So that throws the whole question of how the eye relates to consciousness and the psychological functions into another very different perspective, which
illustrates how you could be conscious in the physical body, but then you could be conscious in the astral body and the astral realm, and then be conscious in the mental realm. Like, theosophists have a very interesting view of the kind of process of reincarnation, and it's similar to Gurdjieff, at least in part. And theosophists say you undergo your first death, which is the death of the physical body, and it kind of goes back into the earth. And as Gurdjieff suggests, certain energies feed the moon. And then they say you exist within the astral realms, of which there are seven levels of the astral realms. And that is according, in a sense, to your emotional desire makeup. So people can haunt the earth or be drawn into lower hell-like worlds or suffer periods of kind of retribution and purgatory conditions. In theosophy, they say you undergo, after a certain period of time, you undergo your second death, which is the disintegration of the astral body. And Gurdjieff has a special term. He uses the term rascuernos. And the first rascuerno is the death of the physical body, and the second rascuerno is the death of the astral body. And so in theosophy, you suffer the second death, and then you exist within the mental realm, in the mental body, even though a person's stay on that plane may be very meager because they haven't kind of developed a mental body, so they can't function or maintain awareness on that plane. And then in theosophy, you pass back to the causal level just briefly, and then you begin a new cycle. And you then begin again with a mental permanent atom, which begins to vibrate, and you begin to form a mental body related to what you had before, and then an astral body, and then a physical body again. So you kind of descend from within without through these planes of existence, and then get incarnate again. And we go through cycles of this, and the idea of people talk of kind of escaping the cycle of reincarnation, and I guess that is to attain to the level of the causal plane and then exist there and not have to come back through the cycle of life and death again, but to attain to a higher eternal level. And Gurdjieff actually talks about if we attain to the fourth room, which is kind of having developed the spiritual body and attained to the causal body, then he says a person is immortal within the limits of the solar system. So it's like you exist within different planes or within different lives through the length of the solar system. So it's an amazingly alternative concept of the kind of nature and structure of human existence, eh, Jim? And you just don't get any consideration of such ideas anywhere. I never did within the educational system. Maybe glimpses of things here and there.
Yeah, it's funny too, because it's when you begin to read the mystical and esoteric literature, you realize that all these idiotic comments that typically with which people typically dismiss mysticism are so stupid. It's like, you know, they're so profoundly dumb in the sense that they clearly have absolutely no idea. It's like people have this very bizarre, superficial cartoon version of what mysticism is, and they use the word mystical pejoratively to refer to anything that's unsubstantiated or vague or misty or somehow beyond rationality. And yet when you begin to understand the study of the mystical and the esoteric traditions, and I mean people don't even recognize the esoteric tradition in mostly in Western thought, you realize that there's this incredibly profound, highly sophisticated, dynamic, complex body of teachings, which many of which are in the different teachings have different emphases and lead to different perspectives on things, but have this central core of ideas that are so highly complex and so coherent and so utterly rational that it's amazing that everything in Western education and scholarship is so divorced from this. And I mean, it's funny, I was just actually reading some notes I had taken from one of David Ray Griffin's books, where he goes into sort of what happened in terms of the history of the development of Western science and the split, or the sort of the creation of this idea that science and religion are somehow antagonistic. And it's really it's funny, because now we have the cartoon version of that, is that, you know, religion is faith-based and has nothing to do with reality. It's just sort of wishful thinking, and science is empirical and it has a self-corrective
mechanism. Oh, yeah, that false, duality,
And when you actually read the scholarship and that, you know, when you actually read what really happened, it's so much more complicated than that. But along the way, really, it's everything. Science didn't disprove mystical or religious or any kind of animistic ideas about the nature of the universe and consciousness and the self and I. It just banished them. And really, I was thinking about, you know, in terms of the problem of God's contracting universe. It's not just that the problem refers to Carl Sagan's view that as science advances, there seems to be more, less and less for God to do, as science explains more and more in terms of providing natural, quote unquote, explanations of phenomena which were previously attributed to the gods and to supernatural realities and forces and influences. But in a sense, the rise of materialist reductionist science has also contracted God's universe, because science wants to look at, materialist science specifically, wants to look at everything through a very restricted set of lenses and with certain binders on. And so really God's universe contracts in that way too, because there are so many domains which are just not accorded any consideration. They've been banished. So science, so in a way, that's the other side of the contracting universe, is that, yeah, the universe is contracting as science advances, because science is looking at it in very specific terms and through very specific lenses. And yet, as I say, that the amazing thing is, for anybody who actually takes the time to begin to and makes the effort, and it has to be grounded in some sort of personal effort. This isn't a matter of belief. It's a matter of acquiring certain methods and adhering to certain disciplines and applying them to your own life and to your understanding of the nature of other people's lives and the nature of the cosmos, it's a very long, involved process. And it was like, over 35 years we've been doing this, and look at what we've achieved to a certain extent is very interesting. But, I mean, there's still all of this that we don't know, and all of it, it's so much more complex, and really it provides some answers, but it also creates more questions. It's just like any good science, it tells you something, but it leaves so many unanswered questions and so many things to explore. And that's what's so fascinating about the entire mystical esoteric tradition. It's just a different way of looking at things, but I would argue that actually in concert with, and I think this is your essential, what you've tried to achieve in your work, is that it really actually provides a much better understanding of what we have established in modern science. Like, it's complementary to science, but it goes beyond science and the materialist position, and that way it actually completes science in many ways.
Yeah.
And also leads to a drastically different reconstruction of certain issues, and certainly leads to a different way of construing certain things and approaching them.
It's funny because what I see among mainstream science is that, yeah, their attitudes towards the paranormal is like pseudo-scientific. Because I remember 30, 40 years ago studying the parapsychology research and trying to follow it through the past decades, kind of. And there's just such overwhelmingly good evidence for out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, reincarnation, poltergeist phenomena, ghost phenomena, different spiritual or psychical healing. Like, there's just such a vast evidences, and not all of, like, good scientific quality, but, you know, no, nor is other areas of scientific research, you know.
Yeah.
But you kind of put it together, and it kind of like there's overwhelming evidence that something's going on, and these things seem to be possible. And unfortunately, the mainstream of science just kind of denies the existence of all these kind of alternative evidences, which challenge their essentially soulless psychology. And because the last century of science and psychology has denied the existence of the human spirit or soul, so in favor of a materialist perspective. And then there's this kind of arbitrary dismissal of these evidences, because these are evidences.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they definitely establish what they claim to establish, but they're evidences of phenomena that occur and are, you know, reported by hundreds and thousands and millions of people all through human history all around the world. So there's something more, kind of. And modern scientists it's like they close their eyes. It's like, okay, I'm going to close my eyes and these things won't be there. They won't exist, you know. And that's what science has done. They've kind of closed people's eyes to trying to even understand these subjects. And it's certainly not taught anywhere, in my experience, within the university system or the high schools or public schools.
Well,
there's a lack of... Sorry, Jim?
Oh, I was just going to say, it's so funny because it's like, as you say, they close their eyes, and the peculiar way that they close their eyes is that they say, well, this isn't explicable in terms of materialist framework. And, you know, it's very much like the skeptics say that, you know, that the problem with people who believe in religion is that they want to reduce everything to an explanatory framework, and they're not open to changing their minds about things. But that's exactly the way the material scientists deal with this enormous body of evidence which doesn't fit into their established perspective, and they, you know, they'll acknowledge on the one hand that there are all sorts of anomalies and enigmas and mysteries out there that science hasn't explained, but they say, well, you know, just give us enough time and the materialist perspective will eventually, you know, provide an explanation of everything. It's like what Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, calls promissory materialism. Yet, really, and this is where the whole issue of consciousness is, it's consciousness is fundamental to all of this, these arguments and all of these debates between science and religion and within science about the efficacy of the materialist position. When you understand consciousness as being something that which is not reducible to the psychological functions and which is not simply produced by the neurological activities of the brain, it changes everything, because then you have if you can understand consciousness from a mystical esoteric perspective, if you come to it with that understanding, it changes everything, because it creates a much more comprehensive framework in which all of these anomalies somehow can be accounted for, or at least are not barred from by, you know, adhering to the materialist perspective. I'm not saying that properly, but they're not prohibited by the existing explanatory framework. And as we've quoted this before, but Uspensky has this great quote where he made the statement in I think it's in Tertium Organum, where he says that if this is 100 years ago, but if you take all of these anomalies and enigmas within established science and bring them together, it's like they're system destroying facts, because they overwhelm, there's so many of them that are so overwhelming that they reveal that there's something fundamentally wrong with the existing materialist perspective, and that it clearly isn't going to explain everything eventually, and there's clearly a need to approach things in a fundamentally different way. And I think that's, as you say, I think that's in terms of, I said this in my writing about your work, I think that was really one of your really great achievements in terms of your work, is rather than being stuck on the question of, well, are these phenomena real or not, a different approach, and it's a legitimate scientific approach, is to say, okay, well, let's suppose that they are all real. How would we have to understand, for instance, consciousness to allow these things to be real? Like, you know,
how could you explain it all?
It's funny, in a funny way, you know, that is, to be skeptical is just to question things, you know. It doesn't mean adhering to a materialist approach. It means to truly be a skeptic. So in a way, that's a really skeptical attitude too. It's like you, rather than assuming that they're arbitrarily not real, rather than assuming that you can explain them already, you try to say, well, okay, I can explain them, but I'm going to assume that these things are real, so how would they have to be understood? How would they have to understand consciousness to explain them? And that's such a brilliantly different approach to things, and I think that's what's really lacking. It's like this incredible lack of curiosity within the mainstream of psychology and science, and I just think that these phenomena, and there are so many of them, and they're so overwhelmingly documented in terms of, and as you say, with varying degrees, some things are better understood than others. But to me, like I think that the one phenomena which is, I think, the most approachable scientifically is this near-death experience. It's a very relatively recent phenomenon. It's really only the last 35 to 40 years. And remember, it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who studied death and dying and wrote several books about it, said when she first encountered this, her, you know, as a Western-trained scientist, her first response was to say, well, is this real? And after a while, she realized that there were so many instances that question was idiotic. It was like, stop thinking, you know, stop asking that question and start trying to understand what's really going on here, because obviously something is happening which is beyond the scope of the current knowledge and beyond the any current explanatory framework. So there's something fundamentally different here that we have to understand, which has radical implications for our understanding of everything else. And I think that's what the near-death experience has revealed. And if you look at most of the major theorists who have investigated this phenomenon, almost all of them, my understanding in reading, almost all of them begin by being skeptical and trying to sort of disprove that these things are real, and then they kind of realize, oh no, they're real. It's and they do a complete about face in terms of their attitudes towards them, and then they take the perspective, well, how can we explain what's going on? For instance, like I think Raymond Moody started with that perspective. I know Kenneth Ring
right,
started
yeah.
with that perspective. Even Dr. Van Lommel, in the book that I just sent to you, you know, he says that. I mean, I think Michael Sabam, the cardiologist,
he did, yeah,
he did
skeptical.
Too. I mean, it's very interesting how these people start out with that perspective and yet have come to, you know, have come to say, well, this is a very, very intriguing phenomenon.
I was just going to say, I'm a skeptic. I'm skeptical of promissory materialism.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything you should be skeptical about is it's promissory materialism.
Yeah, yeah. I'm of the same
because
mind.
Because it's like if you consider these things and you're not scientific. But really, in my view, it's exactly the opposite. We need to consider these. It keeps bringing me back to that Eddington quote, that science is the effort to kind of put in order, like, the facts of experience.
Yeah, the earnest, like, earnest attempt to set in order the facts of experience, which is a beautiful definition of the true sense of science in the broader sense, and just doesn't restrict science to the materialist perspective or even to what scientists do, because I would argue very, very strongly that the people in the esoteric tradition have been scientists who have studied the spirit and the soul.
Yeah, yeah, and consciousness within themselves.
And I think it's entirely scientific in the sense that it's empirical. People have observed things, and that there is a community. Like this is Ken Wilber sort of defines it this way: is that there's a community where you check for verification and for, you know, rejection of your hypotheses, and it satisfies the criteria of science, is that, you know, things are discarded if they're proved not to be correct, or if they're proved to be inadequate methods, or, you know, it's a very scientific approach, and the body of knowledge has withstood the test of time, and as I say, the fact that all of these different traditions throughout the ages have come to this very similar perspectives on the nature of consciousness and various aspects of consciousness, such as the existence of a divine spark or some sort of higher light element within ourselves, and the equation of consciousness with light is in its of itself. I mean, that's science. That's an objective. That's an objective body of knowledge. It doesn't mean that it can't be refined, or that there might be elements of it that are incorrect, but
or that it answers all the questions.
Or
it doesn't.
Right.
It just raises all new ones.
Yeah,
you know,
at least
at further levels of complexity. You know, it doesn't solve all the mysteries of the universe. It's just making a step. Like, just to go back, I want to pick up a couple things you referred to, that Uspensky quote. Like, I think he actually says, if we could gather together all the system-destroying facts, it would wash away, like, everything we think we know, kind of. And it reminds me of how Thomas Kuhn describes a scientific revolution. And he describes, like, different stages and how there's, like, an accumulation of inexplicable phenomena. And it's like the accumulation of those phenomena, and then all of a sudden it kind of brings about a whole shift, a paradigm shift, and a whole new way of thinking. And I think what the real paradigm shift is, in a sense, is shifting from a unidimensional view of man and, you know, human beings as material beings, to the paradigm shift is to us as being multidimensional beings.
Yeah.
Because that's the essence of it. Like, the divine spark is kind of most inward. But beyond that, there's said to be these different bodies and different planes of existence. There are afterlife realms. You do go through judgment processes. You do have life reviews. You can travel down tunnels into realm of light. You can go into lower worlds and be surrounded by snakes and find it very hot. Like, there can be hell to pay. you know, that Gurdjieff describes how it's like the subtle bodies in people who've been really evil and had malicious influence through their life. It's like they have to be broken down again. He compares it to a cosmic smelter, where you have like elements that crystallize in a really distorted way, and so you have to break it down into the basic elements again to allow for kind of new possibility. Gurdjieff talks in this way, like breaking down the crystallization in the being bodies of the Hasnamasas, who he talks about as negative characters. So, but I mean, I think that's the overall kind of label or an overall way of seeing it, Jim, is to see it's a paradigm shift from a kind of unidimensional materialist perspective to a multidimensional model of human existence. And I mean, I've been convinced through my life of it, and it's not just through scientific evidences and studying other people's research, but it also makes sense of different experiences I've had through life, like out-of-body experiences or psychical experiences. I've not had a near-death experience. I've had different kinds of experiences of illumination and enlightenment on different levels at different times in my life. Different other kind of mystical states, mystical emotions at times. So all these things, like it all fits together. It's all intelligible if you have this kind of model of a multidimensional human existence. Like it's not so, you know, it's not so hard to understand, kind of.
Well, again, and also the idea that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe, and that somehow that there this isomorphism between psychology and cosmology, and that somehow these worlds that we potentially can realize within ourselves are paralleled somehow by the cosmic structure, and
yeah,
I think for me too is I just. You know, I mean, there's all of the anomalous experiences, but then there's just the plain old simple experience of being alive and conscious. I just, you know, for me, life and consciousness are miraculous, and I just, I don't see, to me, it makes more sense that we somehow originate in higher dimensional, from higher dimensional life and conscious sources rather than we just sort of blindly evolve accidentally out of material processes. I just don't.
Yeah.
There's this,
yeah.
Talk about a quantum leap. And I mean, I was actually writing about this earlier today. It's no more of a miracle to attribute something to God's will as some sort of supernatural intervention than it is in the modern scientific materialist perspective to somehow, it's like Stanislav Grof talks about this, is somehow, you know, matter which is blindly evolving and inert and somehow gains the properties of life and consciousness. It's like, you know, nobody can explain that.
And produces a being that can reflect upon its place in the
yeah.
universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
come close to answering the mysteries of the universe.
Yeah, and then,
yeah, it's a pretty good random fluctuation.
Yeah, and then, you know, this idea that somehow that certain people have had these experiences where they experience themselves as one with the cosmos, with one with everything. I mean, it just defies. To me, it's illogical. Like I just don't get it. You know, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I do get it in a sense because I think that the materialist perspective, and there's a very good discussion of this in Maurice Nichols' book Living Time, when he talks about the materialist perspective and how it's related to the lower functioning of consciousness in the waking sleep state, how the reducing everything to the sensory is sort of the lower functioning of the mind, I think it's a very beautiful discussion he has of it, and I think it's very appealing because in a sense, that's how we kind of see things on a most basic level. But then there's all of these other things. It's just not satisfying intellectually to me that as an explanation of things. But it's also like there's all these other experiences that we have in our life, which tend to suggest that clearly there's much more going on here than can be explained in terms of these material processes, and that we have experiences of higher consciousness and experiences of spirit or soul or some sort of something that's from a naturalistic perspective is supernatural, there's just too many of these, and it happens to too many people for it to be easily dismissed. I mean, in fact, mm-hmm. you know, it just, as you said, we were talking about earlier, when you really begin to, like Uspensky's phrase is, to wash away things, when you really begin to gather all these things together and to really see the bigger picture, you realize, no, this doesn't make it. You know, there's something fundamentally wrong with all of this. And I think, too, like, from the work that we've been doing for the last many years on the holographic paradigm, I think there's a way of understanding many different things which suggest that even in terms of modern physics and modern science, the inadequacy of the materialist perspective has really been revealed. It's like the Popper again, Karl Popper says, you know, that under the development of modern physics, matter has transcended itself. And it's like, mm-hmm. so in a way, like, what does it mean to be a materialist in a world where science has really established that the material perspective is mythological, or that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It has. You're right. That's a really good way of describing it. Like modern science, because it just reminds me, like, the newest models in physics, they are 11-dimensional models, because they think 4-dimensional space-time is based upon 7-dimensional hyperspace. So modern physics, like the physicists themselves only see, like, material world in a way within physics itself is just illusory. All it's due to is broken symmetries in higher dimensional space, kind of. Yeah. Like, it's illusory. It's not the prime source substances.
Yeah, and again, that's where there's a paper by David Bohm in one of David Ray Griffin's books on the postmodern science, and that's what how Bohm describes, and Bohm says it's like his ideas of the holographic paradigm and his work, he sees like, he said, you know, modern physicists have taken the approach that the physical manifest universe is the primary reality, and he's sort of turning this on its head and saying, no, it's not the primary reality, it's a secondary, it's a reality, it's a projection of something more primary, and we have to, if we really want a real, that's why he calls it postmodern physics, postmodern physics isn't going to deal with that which we can observe externally in four-dimensional time, space-time, but rather it's this more primary reality and how we have to understand it, and that's where he tries to deal with what he calls is like this startling idea that both relativity theory and quantum mechanics, the two most important theoretical perspectives in modern physics, have come to this idea of the undivided nature of the universe for entirely different reasons. And I mean, mm-hmm. Bohm was, you know, he wrote one of the best textbooks on quantum mechanics and was really struck by this anomaly. And again, it's this idea of a scientist inverting the conventional wisdom and trying to step outside of the established approach to things and say, well, rather than trying to, you know, deal with what we see in space-time and the material world as being primary, what if there's something more primary, and this is just really, as the mystics have asserted, this is all a projection of higher dimensions, and that's Bohm's approach, and I think that underlines how limited the materialist perspective has become.
Yeah.
Especially, it means really science has in the 20th century has destroyed materialism as a comprehensive explanatory framework. It just doesn't cut it.
Yeah, but they don't apply it though to human psychology in a way like. Physicists now essentially have a transcendental level that they speak of, like, you know, they do speak of like seven-dimensional hyperspace, and in the holographic model they talk of these alternate space dimensions with mini black holes in and things like that. So but no one ever applies that kind of thinking to reconsider human psychology or what human beings are.
Yeah.
I was going to just go back. One, I always liked what Swami Prabhupada stated most simply. He says, life comes from life.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like when you were speaking, another way of saying it is life comes from above rather than from below.
Right.
Like life comes from life, from a life source in superior, higher dimensions, rather than being produced by coagulation of material elements on the material plane. So life comes from above rather than from below. And I mean, it's amazing, like in science can tolerate different perspectives. You know, science doesn't have to be uniform in its kind of thinking. So the idea of, like, to argue that life comes from life or life comes from above in the kind of way we're suggesting is a scientific viewpoint.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's valid. You know, it needs to be supported by its data, and it can present data that's in contrary to a materialist perspective.
And again, you know, that's another aspect of that. That was one of the things that when I first was introduced to the Fourth Way that really struck me, is that most of the cosmological teachings that Gurdjieff was putting forth, I was willing to sort of grant, suspend my judgment and grant them consideration simply because I realized I didn't understand them, but I was so convinced by the psychological teachings that I just sort of thought, well, you know, I'll try to understand these things as I progress. But one of the things that did strike me that I really liked was his idea of the ray of creation and of a hierarchy of world orders that descended through an involutionary process. And I realized that over time that this idea of an involutionary and an evolutionary process both occurring
yeah.
at the same time is so critical, and that's I think
yeah.
that's completely absent from modern thinking. And in a way, like, if you take something in a most simple sense, like if you have everything in the universe is concentrated in a single point, a singularity, and there's an explosion, you have this massive differentiation, really, like that's, you know, that's, in a way, like, that is involution. It's not evolution, it's involution, because everything's coming from a unity, right?
Yeah, from a state of unity, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, like, the whole universe is in its origins, it is an involution of something that was coherent at one point, and then, literally at one point, and then has been manifesting and
fractured over and over again.
Yeah,
fractured and multiplied and
differentiated throughout
yeah.
the cosmos. And
the
yet,
many from the one, kind
yeah,
of.
And
yeah,
and then there's this process of evolution going on, which in evolution mechanically happens on a scale of time, which is, you know, Gurdjieff said is like meaningless to human beings, but an evolution of things returning to the source. So like there are these two different currents, and man sort of stands between these two currents, and can either evolve or involve. And in a sense, Gurdjieff says, you know, we can evolve mechanically to a certain extent, but real evolution of consciousness, it can only be done as a result of effort, can only be achieved as a result of effort. And the advantage of the single human being is that they're so small that in terms of the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter if they evolve or if they don't evolve. And so, mm-hmm. you know, the individual is free in a sense to work to evolve consciousness. And I like that idea a lot. And I think, like, that's, that idea of the two currents is something that's missing from our current paradigm in science, which I think is really, really valuable. It's like there's so much attributed
yeah.
to evolution as this incredible intelligence, this force of nature, but it's always said to be blind and operating, you know, unintelligently and all randomly and everything. It makes no sense, you know. I mean,
and no concept in terms of of evolution in terms of a human being able to participate actively in as being able to effect some kind of change in themselves in any way.
Yeah, no,
like they evolve in their being, kind of. Like they don't have that concept.
No.
No.
Not at all.
I really like how you described the involution from the singularity. That's a perfect way of describing it. And it's funny how scientists use the word evolution. It's kind of like any kind of change is evolution.
Yeah.
You know, it's so valuable to have the concept of the complementary streams, like the involutionary and evolutionary going on. Gurdjieff would say that they're both part of the trogo-auto-egocratic process,
right,
where everything eats and everything is eaten. So that there's kind of these exchanges of cosmic substances on all these different levels.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, this idea of an involutionary process is like really is a way of also understanding that our life force and our consciousness is actually being stepped down from these higher dimensional sources, and somehow, even biologically, like our physical bodies are dynamically changing all the time, and the matter is being replaced. I mean, I would suggest that rather than this happening mechanically, I would suggest that there are fields of intelligence which are informing and which are organizing the physical manifestation of our body and the replacement of the elements in our body, and that's another way of understanding the involutionary process with respect to life and consciousness. So it's like all the time, everything is breaking down. Everything is degenerating, but at the same time, everything is being replaced and informed and organized. I don't see how this happens mechanically and unintelligently. I think it just defies intelligence to account for this kind of intelligent dynamic activity without sort of positing the existence of some sort of realm beyond the physical. Again, it stands the whole problem of biology on its head too. It's like it's not everything isn't just coming from the lowest levels and building itself up. And it's like actually one biologist that Friedhof Capra quotes in The Turning Point, Paul Weiss, says you can't really, starting if you decompose everything in biology to its lowest levels, you can't really account for a human being or any being by sort of trying to build things up, that things emerged at different levels that mm-hmm. aren't predicated on the lower processes. And so he said you couldn't, you can't reverse engineer a human being, for instance, or even like a giraffe or a glowworm, by breaking it down to its constituent metabolic processes and structures. You know, it's much more complicated than that. And always we still look in modern biology, we look at the physical, which, you know, makes sense to a certain extent. I mean, but there's an alternative perspective on that some people like Sheldrake have talked about that there are things going on in the subtle dimensions which are informing these physical processes.
What you were saying, it was so interesting. When you were saying there's something underlying the body that helps form the body, do you know in the Kabbalistic ladder of Jacob, where you have four world orders, okay, the lowest one is called the world made. So that's kind of the material realm. And the next one is the world of formation.
Formation, yeah.
Yeah, which makes perfect sense. Like, that's what you're saying. There's this underlying energetic intelligence field that is informing, you know, the molecules and processes of the body. And we see it, like, where you see, like, depictions of the chakra system and the subtle anatomy. Like, that's all in the levels of the formation and creation in Kabbalistic study. So it's this whole underlying dimensionality to human existence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, certain people at, like Harold Saxton Burr at Yale in the 30s have talked about L fields, like life fields, which underlie things, and it's a shame that more people haven't pursued his research, you know, because I think that really, as you say, like the depiction of the chakras is a perfect example, or like even the existence, like the vital energies, like throughout history, there've been all sorts of, you know, theories on vital energies, like and in yoga, that the prana is that there's something, it's this subtle energy which is a life force, which is a higher dimensional subtle energy which underlies and which informs and provides the dynamic life force. You know, it's
yeah.
not. Again, this is an involutionary process. It's something higher is manifesting as something lower, rather than the modern approach, the current scientific approach, which is trying to explain everything from the bottom up. It's a very different perspective, but I just think it makes more sense. I think it's a more comprehensive perspective, and I think it addresses a lot of the anomalies that are sort of swept under the carpet and politely ignored in modern science.
And it also provides an inspired model, like prospectus for what it means to be human, and to consider that, wow, we might exist through these different planes and have different lives, and you know, life is ever more. It's just like it open. You know, it's like you climb the level of the first, and you realize, oh, materialism didn't work. And then you open up your eyes, and like, holy smokes, it's like a new world, in a way. You know,
yeah, and
what it would be beyond passing beyond death, and like really existing in these afterlife planes. Like, if what we're saying is true, everyone listening to us is going to go through this and has gone through it previously. They just live in forgetfulness. You know?
Yeah, and
it's a grand epic tale. Like it's so. You know, it shows like how materialist philosophy is like so meager and puny by contrast, in my view. You just kind of, you live and you die and that's it. You're an animal, you know.
Yeah.
You do whatever you want while you're here, because, you know, versus that there are afterlife realms and we're multidimensional beings, and, you know.
That's funny because, you know, the standard... and I was just reading it in the introduction to Carl Sagan's The Varieties of Religious of Scientific Experiences, his Gifford lectures, and Andrian's talking at the beginning about his perspective on science and religion. And again, she reiterates sort of the standard skeptical materialist comment about religious teachings, is that they seem so provincial and so local and so outdated and everything. I'm thinking, well, to me, like, that's the way I see materialism. I think it's it's outdated. It's just it in no way deals with the complexity of what it means to be human, or the complexity of the existence of the universe. Here's a quote from Francis Crick, which I mean, this is incredibly ironic, but it speaks to, I think, everything we've talked about here on the program today. It says, "I myself, like many scientists, believe that the soul is imaginary, and that what we call our minds is simply a way of talking about the functions of our brain." And then he goes on, he says, "Once one has become adjusted to the idea that we are here because we have evolved from simple chemical compounds by a process of natural selection, it is remarkable how many of the problems of the modern world take on a completely new light." And I'm saying, yes, I'm sure it is. And I would argue that once one realizes that's complete poppycock, it's remarkable how many of the problems of the modern world can be seen in a completely different light. I mean, it's like, it's so funny, like when people, again, it's like it's another aspect of the contracting universe. It's like, yeah, poof, gone are all these problems, because I know that we just evolved from simple chemical compounds. It's
that explains everything.
Yeah, it's like Adam, I was saying, you know, I'm an aggregate of chemical compounds, and when I die, which is funny, when I die, like, that's the end of me. It was like, but when my body dies, but that's a funny thing.
Yeah, but
he says when I die. What is death? Like, why do they die?
Then Asimov says, I'd prefer my nothingness. So
yeah,
I think he's going to have his little heart's desire.
But it's funny. Like, I mean, why does the body die if it's just like this process? There's something missing there. Why does
Yeah, there is. And I mean, even the I die. What I die? There is no I.
Yeah, there is no I. How can it die? It's like, what's her name does that too, is Susan Blackmore in Conversations on Consciousness, and she says that she has studied Buddhism, and that she's, I don't know if she identifies herself specifically as a Buddhist, but she says there's no real self, and then she says, I myself don't believe in the self sort of thing, but, you know, it's like, it's like where the guy who she says he's having a conversation, and whether or not he believes in free will, and he says, I have no choice but to believe in free will.
That's good.
I mean,
wow, that's clever. I have no choice but to believe in free will.
It's funny because there's so many things like this that it just, what it just
paradoxical.
Shows you, it's the catch-22. It's like our language really isn't equipped to deal with the complexity of our existence, you know, and we have all these categories where we sort of box ourselves into these untenable positions, which that's, I think that's one thing that too is that in the mystical and esoteric tradition is like there's this very precise language which is a much more, I find, much more convincing way of describing the human experience. I can instantly recognize when I'm reading somebody who's articulating an esoteric teaching, I feel that I can recognize whether or not they know what they're talking about just by reading them, because there's just this incredible coherence and elegance to the what I would call the genuine teachers and masters, which is makes everything else that seem like just so much wiseacring, and you compare it to modern psychological theorizing, and it's like talking to a six-year-old or, you know, versus a PhD, you know, it's that striking. Like there's a
I remember that the first book I was really impacted by that I would say it was esoteric was Uspensky's The Fourth Way, and I think would you say yours was In Search of the Miraculous?
I was reading both of them at the same time.
Oh,
but to hear Gurdjieff's speeches, that's what convinced me. And I think on an earlier program I quoted Jacob Needleman, who was an American philosopher, who's written extensively on esotericism, and he talked about his reading of In Search of the Miraculous and just being kind of stunned by it. And you know, he was a PhD student in philosophy and knew pretty much everything about Western philosophy, or was certainly acquainted with all the major perspectives, and just being stunned by reading this. And he said what really struck him above all else was the authority of Gurdjieff's voice. And as he said, you know, it's funny. It's like it's different. Like for me, I think we both had the same experience. It's like it speaks somehow. Like these teachings speak to a different part of you, and you don't just process them with your mind, but they somehow stir something within you, yourself that you recognize is like a higher level of consciousness or apprehension within yourself. It's very hard to describe it. I'll actually read that quote again on another program, but it's just, I think Needleman is right on the money. That's exactly what I saw. It's like, when I read it, having, you know, being immersed in reading contemporary psychological literature, I just thought, like, this is the real deal. This is what I thought I was going to get when I went to grad school.
Yeah, when you went to university, to learn about things, Well, we're going to need to wind up here, Jim. I was just going to mention, related to what you were saying, though, that the one other concept is that some people have, Gurdjieff describes, a magnetic center.
Yes.
And those people, which he describes as a part of the intellectual part of the emotional center. And those people, in a way, they're drawn magnetically, they're drawn to seek out the truth, like to learn reality. So certain types of teachings appeal to those people who become seekers after truth, in a way. I think in The Fourth Way you'd say they have a magnetic center. And I can see that in yourself and I through our lives. Like, we've had such magnetic centers to be searched out what we have. Okay, we're coming to a close. Thanks, Jim Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario, and this is Christopher from up by Ottawa, and this has been the Zero Point Show. My website is at www.zeropoint.ca. I have a good special on all my 5 books signed and mailed anywhere in North America for $100. I'm trying to promote my writing, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, BBS Radio. Okay, so we'll be back.
Okay.
Good day.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay.
See ya. Bye.
Goodbye.